So the podcast that I actually recorded during the first half of class didn't actually work. It crashed. So I am giving some notes here. I'm sort of re-going through the lecture. Here won't be exactly what I said in the lecture, but it will cover all the salient points. So we're starting here with, in chapter 8 here, with Skinner and verbal behavior. So Skinner wrote a text called Verbal Behavior, and what was sort of novel for this at the time was he was suggesting that ideas are not actually encoded into words by speaker and decoded by the listener. And this was standard sort of theory interpretation in linguistics at the time. Skinner takes a different approach. He says, let's look at this just from the process of behavior, operant conditioning. He says, words actually are behaviors. Let's treat these as behaviors. Therefore, we would expect to see a functional relationship between a word and an outcome. By this we mean that you use a particular word, you will either achieve reinforcement or punishment. Now, in many cases, what may be providing the reinforcement or punishment is going to be social consequences. And this may involve shaping as the individual develops, so through childhood. Now, babies will babble. They just innately do this. They make sounds. The parents will tend to find this very adorable and cute, and will respond to certain sounds with more attention, and respond to certain sounds more than others. So if you've got whatever the particular language is, so if we're in English, if a baby makes a ma sound, that may sound like mama or mum or mother, and the parents may be very excited by this and give lots of attention. If the baby makes a sound or a quit sound, that probably doesn't sound like much of anything, and doesn't get the same amount of attention there. Consequently, let's go with the assumption here that infants like attention, and there's good reason to believe that normal, healthily developing infants do want attention to be picked up, to be cuddled, to have people get close to them so they can see them. Then through this sort of shaping process, if parents respond more to particular types of sounds, baby will make more of those sounds and less of the sounds that do not get that attention. Now, gradually, the parents will be providing attention for more and more complex things, so not just ma, but perhaps mama or mother. So they come to expect more and more sounds that sound more and more like the actual words in the language. So in this way, the child gradually moves out of the random babbling and into using particular sounds. And as well, through reinforcement, the parents will use sounds. For example, if the parents trying to find out what a child wants, you might say, drink, drink, and the child goes, duh. You go, yes, drink. Okay, duh. Okay, good, I'll get you a drink. So he gets a drink. If the child's going, you know, ma, it's like, no, duh, drink. So you get that sort of reinforcement there. This does not only occur with babies, with children. Studies with adults by Greenspoon in 1955 demonstrate this. Greenspoon asked his subjects to provide lists of nouns. So, say, give me 10 nouns. Write down 10 nouns. And what he would do is he'd just sort of like read through the list in front of the subject, and if it was a singular noun, he'd be a little bit derisive. Well, I was like, oh, cat. Right. But if the subject had written down a plural noun, Greenspoon was very excited, very happy about this. Oh, excellent, you know, cars, right, good, yeah, right, way to go. And then he said, okay, right, give me another list of 10 nouns. What he found was that after not too many trials of this, the subjects are constructing their lists almost entirely out of plural nouns. Plurals get reinforced through social validation. They write more. Verplank is something very similar here, but in this case he was interested in opinion statements. So in the case of Verplank, he just had a conversation with his subject. He's got the subject talking on whatever it happened to be. Did you see the football game over the weekend? And if the subject's made an opinion statement, well, in my opinion, the quarterback should be fired, he would get very interested, you know, lean forwards, focus attention on the subject. Right. Oh, that's an excellent point. So he'd get really engaged. If the subject was making statements that were not about opinions, just the price of gas has gone up, or summer is coming, these are not opinion statements, and he'd look distracted, he'd lean away, he'd stare at something else, he'd pick his nose, he'd do whatever, but wouldn't give that sort of attention. What he found was by the end of his half-hour session here, his subjects were making a lot more opinion statements. They had been shaped in the language. Kay, in 59, looked at Freudian and Jungian therapists. He said, okay, now one of the interesting things we find here is that Freudian and Jungian therapists, when working with the patients, find, as Freudian and Jungian theory predicts, that many of the problems that people have will stem from interactions with their family members early in life. He said, now, is that because interactions with family really make things difficult later for you, or is this a byproduct of the conditioning that Freudian and Jungian therapists have had? If you have been trained in the Freudian tradition to look for problems due to family members, if you hear something about a family member, perhaps what's happening is you reinforce that, you are more attentive, you engage your patient more when they're talking about family members or family issues than non-family issues. As such, perhaps you're reinforcing patients when they talk about family and not giving them the reinforcement when they talk about other things. So Kay sat in on many, many, many therapy sessions and recorded this. And sure enough, he found when patients started mentioning family, the therapists would get very focused, be very attentive. They'd redirect. They'd say things like, "That's very interesting. Tell me more about that. So you think it's your father's love of his car over you that created the problems you're having now?" Okay, so what's happening here is we're providing social reinforcement. The subjects discover that when they talk about family members, their therapist becomes very attentive, very involved. They become the focus of the attention. They talk about it more. They get more attention. So this follows. Now, this doesn't mean the therapists were being intentionally misleading or during the therapy, but this is a byproduct of the way that the therapists had been trained. They've been trained to expect family is going to be the root of many of these issues and problems. What we can say here is that language is complex, so the acquisition of language is going to be ongoing. This will occur over the course of individuals' lives, and different situations, different cues will lead to differences in how language is utilized and where it's utilized. Depending on what group of people you're with, you may speak in a different way. If you are going for a job interview, you will probably not use a lot of profanity in your job interview session. On the other hand, if your friends tend to swear a lot about things, then if you're just chatting with your friends, you will probably speak in a somewhat different manner. We've got to remember as well, a lot of vocal reinforcement occurs without our sort of conscious knowledge. There's chunks of our brain that process body language cues and things like this. And these sort of social cues do provide reinforcement and punishment, as happens very, very much without our sort of conscious control. All right. Moving on to insightful problem solving. The vast majority of problem solving really does seem to be done through trial and error learning. Now, this is kind of slow and tedious, and you have to go through a lot of processes. You try different things out, and you see what works and what doesn't work. The idea of insightful problem solving is that you can skip all of that. You can go straight to the solution. It's the light bulb moment, if you will. All these tedious intermediate steps are just gone. Work on this really goes back to a paper by a German psychologist called Kohler, published in 1927. Now, Kohler was not just a psychologist, really was a psychologist. He was also, and he was going after World War I, he was a German spy. So there was a captive population of chimpanzees at the island of Malta, which is in the Mediterranean. And Kohler wanted to go work with these chimpanzees. But Malta was also at the western edge of the Mediterranean, and so all shipping that was going in and out of the Mediterranean had to go by Malta. And the German High Command very much wanted to have information about what ships were coming and going from Britain and France and other countries. And so Kohler was going to be in Malta for 6 months conducting his research with chimpanzees, and he was also going to be spying, collecting data on shipping patterns. Unfortunately for Kohler, he gets stuck in Malta. The war breaks out and gets trapped there for the remainder of the war. Anyways, what Kohler would do was would put some fruit that the chimpanzees very much wanted outside of reach of the chimpanzees. So the chimpanzees would be in a chimpanzee would be in a cage, and the chimpanzee couldn't reach the fruit. He would give the chimpanzee two short sticks. Now, one of these short sticks would not be long enough to reach the fruit, but the sticks would slot together. They'd snap together, and if the chimpanzee put them together, it could use this longer stick to drag the fruit towards the cage so he could reach it. Kohler said that the chimpanzees did not seem to engage in trial and error, but just suddenly got it. Put the stick together without doing anything else. After a while, they just snap it together and then drag the fruit towards them. This seems to be very insightful. However, there are some issues with this. Vast majority of studies show that learning is a very slow, gradual process. And, in fact, nobody has really been able to replicate Kohler's study under more controlled situations. And here's the thing. We don't know a lot about exactly what was going on. We don't know the past learning experience of these chimpanzees. We don't know whether they'd seen perhaps a caretaker using a long broom to drag something closer to himself, some trash so he could throw it away. We have no idea what past experience these chimps had had. Maybe they were familiar with using long sticks to move things towards them. We don't know. We also don't know anything about whether or not the chimpanzees were able to observe Kohler putting the sticks together. Now, here's the thing. We talked about Thorndike. We said that Thorndike, his work seemed to show that non-human animals do not learn through observational learning. Now, Kohler would have been familiar with Thorndike's work. He would have read Thorndike's work. And so, based upon this, the general view of the early 20th century here was that non-human animals cannot learn through observational learning. So, it's quite possible that Kohler stood there in front of the chimpanzee cage, demonstrating the sticks being put together. Let's make sure these work, says Kohler in German. Okay, so he clicks them together. It's like, yes, I've got a long stick, pulls them apart, clicks them together again. Now, if he's doing this right in front of the chimpanzee, Kohler's not worried about the chimpanzee learning through observation because he doesn't think they can. But the chimpanzee certainly can learn through observation. The chimp's probably watching, you know, hypothetically, our situation here, our chimpanzee could be watching Kohler and goes, oh yeah, okay. Yeah, they click together like that, and sure enough, you give the chimpanzee the sticks, and so he just clicks them together, off he goes. We know the chimpanzees learn through observational learning nowadays. So this is a very well accepted fact. So the idea of insightful problem solving doesn't seem to work. There are undoubtedly intermediate steps here. You just not may not be aware of them. There's going to be some reinforcement here. So the past experience is really more important. Do not rely on insightful problem solving for your final exam. We can talk about creativity as well. So, I mean, insightful problem solving, some people thumbs up, thinks this is creative. Suddenly, oh, they get a great idea. But let's describe creativity as novelty or the display of original behavior. Now, one of the questions you commonly get is, can you actually make people more creative? Can you train somebody to be more creative? And the answer is yes, you actually can. The way to do this is to provide reinforcement only for novel behaviors. So if someone only receives reinforcement producing something new, then they will start producing more and more novel new behaviors. The formalized study of this in psychology goes back to a woman called Pryor, 1969. Pryor had been working at like a SeaWorld with dolphins. And she and the other trainers were sort of running out of things they could think of to get the dolphins to do for the shows. So finally, somebody came up with the idea, like, why don't we just let the dolphins come up with something? Let's see what they can actually do here. So they said, so if they do a behavior that we've already taught them, don't toss them a fish. They only get a fish if they do something that we've never taught them before, the human trainers haven't taught them. And the dolphins go through a bit of an extinction burst, they jump through a hoop, and they're expecting to get a fish, and they don't. And so maybe the dolphin swims over to the trainer and spits water on the trainer or splashes the trainer. Okay, the trainer got wet, but that's a novel behavior, so boom, the dolphin gets a fish. Oh, pretty quickly, the dolphins pick up on this, and they keep coming up with new things. So after a while, they're no longer just splashing the trainers, they're doing other things, coming up with all kinds of new behaviors, new tricks there. Very effective. Pryor went back to university, did graduate work, and studied this with more controlled situations with pigeons and found very much the same effect. There have been numerous studies that have been done with children, and again, find the same thing. If you reinforce novel behaviors, if you provide reinforcement for novelty, you will get more creativity. You will get new things. In the 1980s, if we look back at this historically, 1980s, Japan sort of burst out of the market as a huge industrial giant there, and new Japanese things were making its way into North America. And with this came new ideas. Most large companies have an R&D division, a research and development division. Now, at the time, in Europe and in North America, if you worked for a company that made tires, if you worked in the research and development section, you should be coming up with things that were related to tires. If you didn't come up with something that was related to tires, you'd get demoted, you'd get fined, you'd get fired. The Japanese brought in a very different approach. If you had a company that was working with tires, if somebody working in their research and development branch produces a new sort of sticky tape, for example, they weren't fired. They were given a raise. You go, wait a minute, but you make tires. How are you going to sell tape? It's like, don't worry. That's not the job of research and development. It's marketing's job to figure out how to sell the tape. If people in marketing can't figure out how to sell this really great new tape, they're going to get fired. It's the job of people in research and development to invent new stuff. All right, so what this led to was a lot of very innovative, novel inventions coming out of Japan in the 1980s. So this approach worked very well. We had a lot of creative things being produced. Now, some studies have come out and said, wait. If you reward, if you give children, for example, rewards for doing tasks, this actually reduces the creativity. They just become stereotypic. Creativity goes down. So you'd never reward children for doing these things. If you do, you stifle creativity. Okay. The problem with these studies, and many of them came out of like education psychology programs, is they've made a huge mistake in terms of their design. These studies were not actually dealing with creativity. What they were doing was providing reward for the completion of a task versus no reward for the completion of a task. So, let's consider here. Let's say we've got a classroom where the teacher tells the children, draw me a picture, okay? So, kids come up, they draw a picture, and she looks at them and goes, lovely, wonderful, and puts a gold star on it. And says, okay, now go back and draw me another picture. And the kids go back, draw another picture, lovely, wonderful, gives me a gold star. Everything that comes, that they come up with, gets the gold star. Well, it doesn't take long for the kids to realize, you know, if you've got the stickers, if they like the gold stars, if these are actually reinforcing, it's like, wow, you know what? If I just make a house, you know, I'm getting really good at drawing houses. I can make pictures of houses really, really fast. If that's what gets you the sticker, bam, there you go. The kid's just going to, you know, this particular kid is just going to start drawing houses. This particular kid will draw kittens. This other kid will draw whatever. They specialize, if you will. It doesn't seem very creative, but the issue is they're being reinforced for task completion. The faster you do the task, the more reinforcement you get. All right, here's our second group, though. Teacher says, draw me a picture. Student comes up. There it is. There's the picture. Teacher says, all right, great. Draw me another picture. Okay, so, you know, student draws, you know, draws a house the first time. Student draws another house the second time. Great. Draw me another picture. Well, they're not really getting anything specifically for drawing houses. They've drawn two houses now. It's getting a little bit boring, so what do you do? Oh, third picture of a house, stick a bunch of ninjas hiding behind it. Bring it up. Great, draw me another picture. All right. House, ninjas, what would the ninjas be fighting? Ah, dinosaurs. Great, so now we've got ninjas and dinosaurs. Bring it up, another picture. Oh, what have we got now? Attack helicopters, right? You know, so maybe the ninjas are riding surfboards and the dinosaurs are on attack helicopters and the house is blowing up. By this point, you're starting to say, wow, this is a really creative drawing, right? We've got like an exploding house. We've got a whole backstory with dinosaurs. And how are they in an attack helicopter? And the ninjas, where'd they come? This seems very creative. Now, if you look at it, you say, you see, we got highly creative behavior by not reinforcing the kids. When you reinforce them, when you reward them, boring. They just do the same thing over and over again. But there's the thing, you weren't actually reinforcing creativity. You got the reinforcement for getting the job done fast. You know, art history is filled with this. You find artists who have spent years starving, something they do becomes successful, it clicks with the public, suddenly they're not starving. You know, they could keep coming up with something new, but what? they're getting paid a lot of money for producing what they've done here. Just churn it out. Do another one. Or bands, right? You know? It's like, you know, the 9th album by Flying Teacup is basically the same stuff they've done on albums 6, 7, and 8. Okay, but you know what? If people keep buying Flying Teacup albums, terrific. They don't have to be original at this point. They're big. So, this can happen. But no, if you reinforce creativity, if you provide rewards for doing novel behavior, and not provide the reward for doing the same old behavior, you will get more creative outcomes. Moving on to superstition here. Hey, there's this guy again. There's B.F. Skinner. 1948, B.F. Skinner put out an article, rather charming little article to read, on accidental conditioning, or called it superstition in the pigeon. Here's what he did. Had one pigeon at a time in a chamber. There's a food dispenser. Every 15 seconds, some grain is dispensed. So this would be a fixed time, 15-second schedule. What Skinner found was that each of his pigeons, he worked with 8 pigeons. 6 of the 8 pigeons produced really distinctive, unusual behaviors. 2 of the pigeons just stood still in front of the food dispenser. Now, here's the thing. The grain shows up every 15 seconds. The pigeons don't have to do anything to get the grain. There is no button they have to push. There's nothing they have to do. It's a fixed time schedule. All they have to do is wait for it to show up, then eat it. But they don't do this. They start doing behaviors. One pigeon starts turning in little circles. Another pigeon starts sticking its head up in the corner. Another one does a little sort of back and forth shuffling and then stands and bobs its head a little bit in front of the food dispenser. So they start doing different things. Skinner says, you know what? This is accidental shaping. This is self-shaping by mistake. It's accidental strengthening of a behavior. Let's consider the pigeon that goes in the little circle here. All right? So, you know, if you've ever seen a dog that's got, you know, an itchy tail, it sort of chases its tail trying to get a hold of its tail to bite on the itchy part. Pigeons do something very similar. If they've got, you know, something itching them on their tail, they'll kind of turn little circles as they try to peck at their tail feathers and do that. Well, imagine you've got a pigeon that's doing this. It starts pecking at its tail feathers, churning in a little circle, and boom, food shows up. Oh, there's the food. Goes over and gets the food. Comes back. Its tail still itches. Starts doing this little thing, a little circle going on here. Oh, boom, there's food. After a few more times of this, there's the correlation that's being picked up. Whenever the pigeon starts turning in a little circle, boop, food arrives. Ah, pigeon wants the food. What should you do? Well, there's a strong contiguity here, right? Turning in a circle is followed by food shows up during that. Let's try that. Let's turn in a circle. Oh, sure enough, there's the food. There we go. So it's accidental. The pigeons don't have to do anything. The food will just show up. But, you know, you rarely get something for nothing. That applies to people. That applies to pigeons. If you want food, you have to do something. You have to fly to it. You have to go to it. You have to peck it. You may have to chase another pigeon away. You have to be on the lookout for food. Okay? Something for nothing? That doesn't happen. You expect that you'll have to do something to get something. Sure enough, you need these behaviors. What about the 2 pigeons that just stood perfectly still? Well, maybe they learned nothing at all. Maybe they figured out, it's just a fixed time 15. Or maybe those pigeons figured that, okay, I've been still and I got food. I must stay really still. If I don't move, I'll get food. We don't know exactly what's going on here, but it's quite possible that their accidental conditioning was to be still and not move. Now, not everyone agrees with this idea. Staden and Simohog, 1971, replicated Skinner's behavior. They had the advantage of having video technology available to them, so they filmed the whole thing. Now, their interpretation of these odd little behaviors that the pigeons would do were based on time. They said they observed what they described as interim and terminal behaviors. So in the 15-second period between grain, they found that for the first maybe 10 or 11 seconds, the pigeons would engage in behaviors that would take up more time. So like pacing from one side of the cage back to the other, and then coming and standing in front of the food dispenser. So that takes up a fair amount of time. Maybe you've taken up 8, 9, 10, 10 or 11 seconds doing this behavior. And then terminal behaviors were short, quicker behaviors, like maybe doing a few head bobs in front of the food dispenser. Now, Staden and Simohog they suggest that what's happening here is the food's going to show up every 15 seconds, not having watches. Pigeons need to know how much time has passed. So what do? They use behaviors that together, the interim and terminal behaviors, will take up about 15 seconds of time. So they do initially slow behaviors that take up the majority of the time, and then shorter or quicker behaviors that finish it off. And by doing that, they're always there waiting for the food to show up. So this can work as well. Who's correct? Well, there's evidence for both. So a study by Brunner and Rovsky in 1961 had teenagers, worked with teenagers, and the teenagers had four buttons on a panel. Now, only the third button, button number three, would provide reinforcement on a fixed interval schedule. But what they found was that the teenagers would go through rather complicated patterns of pressing the button. So 114243, 114243. They get into these little patterns. And when they talked to the teenagers were quite convinced that it was the particular pattern that was responsible for doing this. Now, if Staten and Simelhong were correct, you might think that the students, or the teenagers, the high school students, would have figured out that it's based upon time as opposed to a pattern. But still, the patterns are going to take up a certain amount of time. So it is possible that being on a fixed interval schedule, once they hit three, that if they do it in a particular pattern that takes up the right amount of time, such that the pressing number, button number three, comes after the time has elapsed and therefore they get reinforced, this could support Staden and Simelhong's timekeeping interpretation. But other studies fit with Skinner's interpretation that it's an accidental conditioning process here. So Wagner and Morris let children interact with a little sort of clown doll that would spit out marbles or gumball type thing. So it's kind of like a gumball dispenser that pops out a marble there. And I think what it was the you finally have to push the nose and this marble that's dropped out of the clown's mouth. Now, what they found was the children developed whole sort of little rituals. They'd engage with the clown, they'd have a little conversation with it, or they'd play head and shoulders, knees and toes, ending and poking a clown in the nose and getting the marble. They don't have to do any of this. They don't have to do all these rituals. They don't have to interact with the clown doll. They just have to poke them in the nose. But they do this. And the children are quite convinced that this is the only way to get the marble. Now, just whatever they happen to do that leads to the marble, they seem to follow that. They continue that process. They don't change it. That fits with Skinner's interpretation. Onal, 1987. We had university students here, and there were some levers on a table. They were told to gain as many points as they possibly can. There was a counter up on the wall, that a digital counter that would just periodically give some points. But the points were just given at random intervals. So you had the students doing various things with the levers. One student that would eventually do something with the levers, flip a few levers, climb onto the table, leap off the table, trying to touch the ceiling. I was quite convinced this was exactly what had to be done to get the reinforcers. Of course, it didn't. It was quite unnecessary, but it seemed to fit from her perspective as to what she had to do. So again, accidental conditioning. No timing there. So depending on the situation, it could be that these are accidentally shaped, or it could be there's actually a timing process involved. With many superstitions, there's a social context in this. So, when a behavior gets performed the first time, it's rarely done completely in isolation. Consider something like throwing salt over the shoulder for good luck. Many cultures have this sort of thing. So we can imagine a situation where grandma is sitting at the table at dinner, tosses a little pinch of salt over the shoulder, and the grandchild copies grandma, and everyone's very impressed by this and praises the child for doing this. And what's going to happen? Well, you're probably going to continue this behavior, do it over and over again. Many superstitions that show up in adults that we can actually trace back and do start as children. So observational learning comes in. We'll be talking about observational learning next class, so we'll come back to this sort of process here as well. All right. Delusions and hallucinations. Many delusions and hallucinations are due to neurophysiological processes. However, not all of them are. So not all have a biological basis. Consider, in some cases, patients in mental institutions. Being in a mental institution is not exactly the most exciting way you could spend your time. There's often not a lot to do. There's a lot of patients, relatively little staff. Perhaps you've heard the expression, squeaky wheel gets the grease. Well, if you start claiming to be, uh, if you're a patient in a mental institution and you start claiming to be Napoleon, and I am taking Mr. Henderson's peas because I'm Napoleon deserved them, or, you know, I'm annexing Russia, therefore I get Mr. Henderson's dessert, or whatever it happens to be. What if this patient's name is Mr. Jones? It's like, now, Mr. Jones, says the staff, you're not really, I am Napoleon. It's like, okay, Napoleon. So the emperor wants some more peas? Yes, bring me peas. All right. Now, by doing this, it's like, you know, Mr. Jones here suddenly is like, hey, I just suddenly got a lot of attention. I made the staff do something for me. Cool. All right. Now, how do we know? How can we tell whether it's a social reinforcement that's maintaining these weird behaviors or whether or not it's biological? Well, simple. Stop providing the social reinforcement. If you stop providing the social reinforcement, then, and the behavior goes away, this is being, the reinforcement is a social behavior. If it doesn't, then, you know, time for blood work and, a functional MRI to see what's going on in there. But if stopping the reinforcement reduces the behavior, okay, the delusions are probably due to a reinforcement of attention seeking. I'm going to finish up this with self-injurious behaviors. We've discussed this already. We've said that you can pretty much stop any behavior or alter any behavior by using a reinforcement system. The problem with this is it may take rather a long time. And you don't always have this leisure, the time. In cases where individuals are engaging in self-harming behavior or behaviors that will lead to harm to others, you just may not be able to wait for reinforcement, in which case an appropriately utilized punishment contingency can be effective. Levis and Simmons reported on a case where they had a boy who was a patient who was engaging in self-injurious behavior, hitting himself up to 30 times a minute, hitting himself so hard that he was actually fracturing the orbital bridges around his eyes. They simply didn't have time to implement reinforcement for alternative behaviors here. They used 4 behavior contingent electric shocks to the leg. So, boy hit himself, had a shock, shocked on the leg. Now, you go, that's so mean. It's like, well, first off, Levis and Simmons tested the electric shocks themselves, so they weren't doing any permanent damage here, but they had to find something that was intense enough. They had to find an intense enough punisher. But look, they only used 4 times. There's no permanent damage from the electric shocks here, and it stopped the behavior that was basically destroying the boy's own skull. He was shattering his own skull. So here's the thing. Levis and Simpson's trained clinical psychologists. Do not do this at home, all right? Do not attempt this yourself. You must be trained to have an idea what an appropriate punisher is going to be if you were delivering an aversive like this. Okay, but they were trained, and they tested this on themselves to make sure it wasn't going to be permanently damaging. All right, so self-injurious behavior that can be stopped quickly with an appropriate use of punisher, an aversive. Wolf, in 1967, reported on a case where there was a boy who, in classroom, when the teacher would approach and try to ask him a question, the boy would start injuring himself at his desk, beating on himself with his binder or hacking at his hand with his ruler until he's bleeding. What this leads to is the teacher very quickly backs off and stops asking the question. And once she backed away, the child stopped hurting himself. What we've got here is a beautiful example of escape behavior. This is maintained through negative reinforcement. So the teacher, for whatever reason, the teacher coming to ask a question is massively aversive to this boy. All right? So what makes the teacher go away? Hurting himself. Well, wait a minute, but hurting yourself is going to be aversive as well. Yeah, no question. But apparently it's less aversive than being asked a question. For whatever reason, being asked questions was massively mentally stressful for this child. So, negative reinforcement. Teacher goes away. When you start hitting yourself with a ruler or a binder, behavior increases. Next time the teacher comes close, do it again. She goes away. Great. Maintains the escape behavior. Wolf utilized DRIs and DRA to reduce the injurious behavior. So, could provide the questions for the student in written form. The student had to answer them on paper, and the teacher would take those. Not being asked to perform in front of class, all right. This caused a reduction in the self-injurious behavior. Okay, so that's Chapter 8. Moving to Chapter 10. Chapter 10, we're going to be talking about generalization, discrimination, and stimulus control. Now, we've actually already discussed these concepts. We have actually talked about generalization and discrimination explicitly. We haven't really specifically used the term stimulus control much, but we've actually been encountering it since pretty much the first class here. There's variability in the world. Conditions change. As we've said, one of the great advantages of learning is being able to adapt to these changing situations, conditions. Now, depending on the context, the question is, should you transfer a behavior that you've learned in one case to this new context or not? So should you do this behavior that you've already learned or not? Technical definition of generalization. The tendency for a learned behavior to occur in the presence of stimuli not present during training. So in other words, you learn something, you're trained in something, and you're in a new context, you're missing the stimuli, or there's a different stimuli there. If you do the behavior you're trained in, you've generalized. You've taken from one context and transferred that behavior to a new context. Discrimination is the tendency for a learned behavior to occur in the presence of certain stimuli, but not in their absence. So in this case, you learn in a particular context, you go to a different environment, context, situation, and because there is an absence of certain particular stimuli, you do not perform the behavior. You discriminate. Now, generalization and discrimination really, literally, are flip sides of the same coin. The more you generalize, the less you discriminate. The more you discriminate, the less you generalize. It really is that straightforward. What about stimulus control? Well, like I said, we have been talking about this from the very beginning of the course. This is a situation where stimuli come to exert an influence over a behavior. So in classical conditioning, in the presence of an excitatory conditional stimulus, CS+, the US will be presented. So in the presence of the CS+, you produce a conditional response. In the presence of a CS-, an inhibitory conditional stimulus, the US will not be presented. So you do not produce the conditional response. With operant conditioning, S+, S-, S+ indicates a more reinforcing outcome. So the S stands for the discriminative stimulus. So the S+, discriminative stimulus that says in the presence of this stimulus, there's going to be a reinforcing outcome. You make a response, you get a more reinforcing outcome. S-, discriminative stimulus in its presence, if you make a response, you get a less reinforcing outcome. This may actually be no outcome at all. Maybe nothing happens. It may even be something aversive. Or it may be in the presence of the green light, if you respond, you get 10 pieces of rat chow. In the presence of the orange light, if you respond, you get 3 pieces of rat chow. So the green light would be the S+, and the orange light would be the S-. So 10 versus 3. One's more reinforcing than the other. Okay. So stimulus control is just how these various stimuli in classical conditioning, CS+, is CS-, and operant conditioning, S+, is S-, so you're just going to stimuli, will come to determine behavioral responses. So it's sort of about the application of generalization and discrimination here. Training for this, it's called discrimination training. It could have been called generalization training, just historically it's been called discrimination training. Discrimination training is any procedure that establishes the ability to discriminate between stimuli. Flip side of that, right? The stronger you discriminate, the less you're generalizing. The weaker you discriminate, the more you're generalizing. Okay. More specifically here, discrimination training, really what we're interested in here is stimulus control. This is the process by which stimulus control is established. So in a Pavlovian situation here, you produce your conditional response after training. So you've trained on a particular CS, and then we say if you produce a conditional response for some stimulus that's slightly different from the CS you've trained on, you are generalizing to a certain degree. In operant context, we'll train the subject in a particular puzzle box, so maybe the latch that has to be pushed to open the door is next to the door, and then we'll test in a variant box where the latch is on the far wall. If the subject goes over and uses the latch, then again, there's a generalization in different contexts, but does the behavior. getting generalization from discrimination is not a given. Not be certain that this will actually, or you may get a lot of discrimination. Now, in some cases, that's what you want. In some cases, you want discrimination. In other cases, you want generalization. So how are you going to do this? Depends. Some cases, we do want to generalize. So, you learn to put up your hand in your grade one class, the classroom that we're doing our 281 class in is very similar, but the behavior the 281 classroom here is probably not that similar. Sorry, I mean your grade one class probably had bright colors and pictures and toys, and, a happy teacher, a bunch of other young kids. You had to go for recess. These sorts of things kind of different here, and yet you generalize the if you want to ask a question, the putting up your hand in this very very different environment. So useful. But we don't always want generalization. It's not always appropriate or useful. Consider issues of generalization from violence to video games to the real world. How many people got to school today in a Grand Theft Auto sort of process? You walk out of your house, you pull out your Glock, you shoot out the window with the first car that passes, drag the broken, bleeding body of the driver out of the car, leave it on the sidewalk, and step into the car and drive off. Probably not too many people did that. Some people, though, do have a problem distinguishing video game violence from real-world situations. So in this case, actually, we'd really like to see a lot of discrimination there. We don't want people to take what they learn from video games, especially the violent ones, and transfer it to the real world. That can lead to some problems. Now, being in science, we often like to have some way of actually quantifying things, so we're going to talk now a little bit about what we call generalization gradients. Generalization gradient is just how we measure the degree of generalization or discrimination that has occurred. So we go through some training, and we're going to train with a particular stimulus, and then we will see how much subjects respond to stimuli that are more or less different to the trained stimulus. So we train on one stimulus, we will test on others. Now there's various techniques and ways we can do this. First of these are called a probe trial. We've actually already encountered probe trials. What we do with a probe trial is we train on a particular stimulus, and then every now and then we're going to toss in, say, an unreinforced stimulus, a different stimulus. I'm going to be talking primarily in my examples about operant contingencies. Your textbook uses, I think, predominantly classical conditioning examples, so between us you kind of get the full range there. But the same thing applies. So if you're in classical conditioning, you would have trained with a particular CS. So in the presence of the CS, you are followed by this US. And then for a probe trial or a test trial, we present a CS, a different CS that is not followed by US, to see what happens. In the case of operant conditioning, so in the presence of yellow light, if you respond, you will get reinforced with some food. And this goes on, and every now and then we toss in a probe stimulus, so here a red light, and we see whether or not the subject responds. Now, we don't provide reinforcement for the probe stimulus. If we did, then what we're going to see is the subject will just start responding more and more and more to the probe stimulus. Essentially, we put the stimulus onto acquisition as well. What we're really interested in is whether or not the learning that has been acquired with respect to our training stimulus here, the yellow light, will generalize, will it transfer? Will it generalize or will it discriminate? Now, you might say, well, wait a minute, if we don't provide any reinforcement, won't this extinguish? Won't the subject very quickly just stop responding to this? The thing is, we only present our probe stimulus very occasionally, maybe every 15 or 20 presentations of our training stimulus. Because of this, then, yes, we're not likely to get extinction. There's so much reinforcement coming for the trained stimulus that this maintains the behavior. Now, one of the things about this is if you just want to test one probe stimulus, that's not too bad. That won't take too long. Maybe you need to do 50 trials of the probe stimulus separated by maybe 15, each one 15 training stimuli trials. If we're working, but what if you've got five or six probe trials, probe stimuli that you want to test, 50 of each, so you have maybe say 300 responses there, each of these 300 divided by another 20. So we're up into thousands and thousands of trials that had to be performed. For pigeons or rats, that's not such a big deal. I mean, it's not like they're going anywhere. For people, you know, good luck getting volunteers to come and take part in this, where they have to do, you know, 5,000 trials. I mean, they're hours and hours and hours, if not days. So harder to get people to agree to that. Fortunately, there's another technique that we use. It's called extinction blocks. So in this case, you train a stimulus to asymptotic performance. Then you test in what are called blocks of extinction trials. Once you switch into the extinction blocks, none of the stimuli are going to be reinforced at all, including the stimulus that was trained on. Wait a minute, won't that lead to extinction? Yes, it will lead to extinction. Exactly right. That's why we call it extinction blocks. But don't worry. The amount of extinction is going to be constant across the stimuli. Everything is going to be extinguishing at the same rate here. Now, typically, when you do this, you're only going to present each stimulus in once in a block, and across blocks, you will randomize the order of stimuli. So, looking at our next one here, our example of extinction blocks, during training, we're going to present, say, the yellow light, and we'll present it, and we'll get up to an asymptotic performance, a nice stable steady state of responding. So our subject learns the presence of the yellow light, make this response, get reinforced. Then we'll switch into our extinction block. So we'll have a red light, there's our yellow, it'll be the green, blue, and purple. Now we've trained on the yellow light, but we want to see how much the subject will respond to these other colors of lights. We'll treat them as similar or different. And then we go through our block two extinction trials. So again, we've randomized the order here, stimuli presented in a different order, and block three, and so on, and so on. Now you can continue to go with this until there's no responding to anything at all, or you say, oh, I only need, you know, 30 presentations of each stimulus, so whatever it happens to be. Now, what we're going to be doing is recording the number of responses that are made to each stimulus, or the frequency of responding, or the rate of responding, whatever it happens to be there. Intensity of the response, whatnot. So, for example, let's say here in block one, we have 4 responses to the red light, 20 to the yellow, 15 to the green, 12 to the blue, and 3 to the purple. So we record all that. Not surprisingly enough, most responding is being made here to the yellow stimulus. Well, that's what you trained on. Then our second block, we get a different pattern here. So see, everything's sort of gone down by a bit. And then our third block, things have gone down even further. Now, we take this data, and we can count up the totals. So, for the red, we've got in block one, 4 responses, block two, 3, and block three. 1 responses for over our 3 responses, our 3 blocks here, total of 8 responses for yellow, 20, 15, 10, so total of 45, and so on. We do it for the rest. Very simply now, we just take and plot this as a graph, and the graph is called the generalization gradient. So here we've got our responses on the y-axis, and we've got this stimulus continuum on the x-axis. Now in this case, I've just arranged these by the wavelength of light, so red, yellow, green, blue, purple, and we plot the values there. So 8 for red, 45 for yellow, 30 for green, 22 for blue, and a lowly 4 for purple, connect the dots, and there's our generalization gradient. Now, what we find here is the subject responded very, very strongly to yellow. Well, no surprise, that's what the subject has been trained on. How about green? Well, it gives 30 responses to green. Now, 30 is not 45, but 30 is a pretty good number there. What this suggests to us is that this particular subject sees green as being somewhat similar to yellow. Let's compare that. And blue's down at 22. Let's consider, say, our red or our purple, 8 and 4 responses, respectively. So, you know, 30 responses to green. So green is kind of similar to yellow. It's not yellow, but the subject seems to respond to it fairly strongly. On the other hand, the red and the purple seems here that it's very clear. So, I mean, no, these are not really anything like yellow at all. So our green, our subject, generalizes. Says, yeah, I'm going to treat green as being kind of like yellow. For the red and the purple, we've got much less generalization, or if you prefer, much stronger discriminations. Whoa, no, these are definitely not like yellow. discriminate. So if we look at different generalization gradients, if you've got a fairly flat gradient here, this would say there's no real discrimination. Or conversely, if you prefer this high generalization, the subject treats all of these stimuli more or less the same. In the case of our middle one here, there's a stimulus that's being responded to fairly strongly, and then fairly strong responding to some stimuli that are similar to it. And as you get more and more dissimilar, you get less and less responding. So we've got some discrimination, some generalization. So things that are similar to the stimulus you're trained with, you respond to. Things that are dissimilar, you respond to less. Finally, the last one here, this narrow generalization gradient, the very pointy one on the right, we have high discrimination and low generalization. The subject responds to stimuli that are very similar to what it was trained on, but once you get beyond a certain degree of similarity, don't respond. So things that are only a little bit different do not get very much in the way of responding. Now, we've just been talking about perceptual stimuli so far. I mean, colors or auditory tones or, you know, frequencies or decibels of sound, whatnot. Could be tactile stimuli, these sorts of things. It doesn't have to be perceptual. It could be abstract features. When we're dealing with abstract features, concepts, if you will, we talk about what's called semantic generalization. It's the term that we use for it. So let's take a look at a little study here. Adults were asked to eat candy. So the candy would be the unconditional stimulus, produced salivation, the unconditional response, while they were shown various words. Now these words stand in for conditional stimulus here. So for example, style, earn, freeze, surf. Now, the subjects are shown homophones. So style, earn, freeze, and surf. Now, homophones are words that sound the same but have a different meaning. So if you look at the spelling, they're spelled different ways, and they have very different meanings. And the amount of salivation that was produced was measured. So again, we're testing here. So we present these other words, style, S-T-I-L-E, and we see how much salivation there is, how much of a conditional response there is. Then the subjects are shown synonyms. These are words that sound different but have the same meaning. So for style, fashion. For urn, vase. For freeze, chill. For surf, wave. So these aren't exactly the same meaning, but they're very, very close. And if you're looking up on the thesaurus, you'll probably find these. What we find here is there is some salivation, some conditional response to the homophones, but there's a very strong conditional response to the synonyms. So we get much more responding there. So that would be semantic generalization. We've learned the concept. As it turns out, young children that are, you know, sort of earlier in terms of learning here, have fewer words and whatnot, they tend to produce greater salivation, a stronger conditional response to the homophones and less to the synonyms. As you get better with language, you see more of a conditional response to the synonyms there. With respect to extinction, so if we go through and do our discrimination training, okay? So let's just say we do some operant training, and we can test, we do a generalization gradient there, and then we'll get our generalization gradient curve, we'll see how much generalization there is. And then we go through and put our trained stimulus onto extinction. So now in the presence of the stimulus, you know, if you respond, you get nothing. We'll see that responding to that stimulus will go down. With no other training or exposure, what we find is if we do another generalization gradient, we will find that the generalization, the responding to these other stimuli, will also be suppressed. Okay? So if you extinguish the trained stimulus, you also eliminate the responding to the novel stimuli. All right? It's kind of interesting. I mean, this is indicating that the what's important here is specifically what you learn about a particular stimulus, that we don't have completely separate memory storage aspects for this, so that the extinction process will affect subsequent generalization. So it's cued back, or it's linked back into the original stimulus that you did learn about there. How about punishment? We've been talking here primarily about, you know, make a response, get something, or you get reinforced. Well, same applies with punishment. Punishment will also generalize. So in the presence of a stimulus, if you make this response and the response leads to an aversive outcome, that is, you're being punished, we find that you will also generalize that to similar stimuli. So a study by Honig and Slivka in 1964, pigeons pecked at a plain disc, so just a blank disc, white disc, and if they pecked that disc, they received some grain, so they got reinforced. But if they pecked a green disc, so a colored disc here, the color is green, they received a shock. Then what they did was they tested, they presented other colored discs. What they found was that the pigeons would peck the least for the colors that were similar to green. So if it was a color that was close to green, they would respond very little to it. If it was a color that was very different from green, they'd respond to it more. So they've generalized the issue of punishment. Is, oh, that's kind of like green. You know, so I was trained on green. This is teal. Teal is kind of like green. I'm not going to respond to that. Oh, red. Red is very much not like green. I will respond to that. All right. And I think that is where we got before the break. So I'll stop here. Whoops, I just realized that's not where I got to before the break, so I will continue here. So differential discrimination training techniques. There are different ways to actually establish discrimination training. That probably the easiest here is what's called presence-absence training. Different ways to do this. In presence-absence means, you know, you've got a stimulus that indicates, again, let's just deal with operant here. So if we've got an S+, the S+, indicates that you make a response, you get a reinforcing outcome. If there's an S-, that indicates you make a response, you get a less reinforcing outcome. So we've got presence, the S+, leads to reinforcement, S- leads to less reinforcement, or maybe no reinforcement, or maybe even something aversive. Okay, two ways to do this right here. The most basic ways of successive discrimination training. You present the S+ and your S- randomly, they alternate. So one stimulus is there at a time. So green light comes on, in the presence of the green light, if you respond, you get reinforced. Red light comes on, in the presence of the red light, you do not get reinforced. Your red light's on extinction, so no reinforcement. And then the next, you know, it randomly alternates. So green, red, green, so on and so on. Simultaneous discrimination training, you present the S+ and the S- at the same time. Okay, so they're both presented together. So here's the S+, here's red and green presented together. Which are you going to pick? You're going to pick one at a time. Okay, so simultaneous discrimination training. Other ways to set this up, some fairly simple presence-absence training. Matching the sample. So these little circles here are meant to represent like lights on the wall or key lights for pigeons. So during training, there's three lights there. Only the middle light lights up. So let's say it's green. If you press the middle light when it's green, the pigeon gets some grain, gets some food. Then in testing, three lights are going to be lit up. Now, if you get the middle light, nothing happens. So it's turned off. But we've got, say, a red light and a green light in the outside positions. So here we've got red, green, and green. Now, the center light tells the subject what they have to pick. They have to match. So the center light is the sample. So if the center light is green, pick the outside light that is the same. So match to the sample. You could also do mismatching. So if the center light is green, you need to pick the non-green one. Mismatch. You have to pick the red. When you do that, then you get reinforced. Okay? So very simple, straightforward. Beloved of cognitive psychologists, delayed matching to sample. So in training, same idea here. The middle key is lit up. If it's green and you respond, you get reinforced. We do that until we've got nice responding. Then in testing, middle light comes on, it's green. Then it turns off. And there's a delay period, 2 seconds, 12 seconds, 10 minutes, whatever it happens to be. Okay, so there's that delay period. Then the outside lights come on. Okay, so here we've got a red, the middle light is blank, and the green on the outside. To get reinforced, you have to remember that it was the green that you saw before the delay period. Okay, you do that, you press the green light, you get reinforced. So this is really being used to determine how issues of forgetting, issues of memory, how long can you remember this. All right, now, the thing with some of these approaches is they're not necessarily always the fastest or most effective way of doing this, even though they're relatively straightforward and easy to implement. You can get into a lot of problems where subjects are actually selecting the S minus. What's this do? Oh, nothing! This can lead to frustration. Frustration makes it often harder to learn. So, a technique called errorless discrimination was established. What you do is you present your S plus as normal. So let's say we're going to use a 60-watt green light, and we'll have it turned on for 10 seconds. In the presence of the 60-watt green light, if you respond during that 10 seconds, you will get reinforced. Our S minus is going to be a red light, but we're going to start by presenting the red light for half a second, and it'll be a 2-watt light bulb. Now, this is going to make it very, very difficult to respond in the presence of the S minus, right? Boom, this light comes on, it turns off, and it's very faint. Whoa, what was that? Was that even a light? Well, I didn't have time to respond. Okay, so what we're doing, oh, there's the green light, it's on for 10 seconds, it's really, really salient. So what's going to happen here is you're going to be responding a lot more to the S plus and very little, if any at all, to the S minus. Now gradually we increase the salience of the S minus to equal the S plus. So maybe we step up to a 5-watt red light bulb for 1 second, then a 20-watt light bulb for 3 seconds, and so on until they're equal. But what's happened here is there's been so little opportunity for our subject to respond to the S minus early on, and so much experience responding to the S plus, we can establish strong stimulus control really quite quickly. You have very little frustration involved here in making the choice, fairly easy and fairly, and you tend to get a lot of discrimination in play here, so less generalization. There's another way of doing this called differential outcomes effects. Here, what happens is different reinforcers are available for different responses. Okay? Nothing too new there. But the reinforcers, specifically are going to be different. So you pull this chain, you get some food. You flip this switch, you get some water. You press this button, you get something else. Nice warm, nice heat in the cage makes your toasty warm. Okay, whatever happens to me. So essentially what's happening is you're learning multiple three-term contingencies. This can produce relatively, really quite fast and strong discrimination training here. The other thing is, you sort of get the idea if you're first just setting this up and during the training, the very actions, the very concept, I should say, of having to make a response to get something sort of generalizes. Sure, it's a chain, it's a switch, it's a lever, various different responses that are made, but you're conditioning the idea you have to do something to get something. And that idea generalizes. Sure, the chain is different from the lever, but it's like, oh yeah, I'm doing something to get something. So you don't have to sort of treat these sequentially. It all happens at once. Okay, so another way of doing this. All right, and actually, now, this is where we ended before the break, so I will stop at this point and then go into the second part of the podcast there to pick up with theories of generalization and discrimination.